are going to be talking about sex addiction and how that relates to acting like yourself. As you know, ICBC stands for Increasing Cold Builds Character. And we're going to be talking about how you build character here. And the part of the brain that's involved in building character, which is none other than our very own friend, the right orbital prefrontal cortex. It grows as our individual identity grows, and it grows as our group identity grows. And now you know that the first part of life is the growing of an individual identity. That's what your infancy and childhood is about. You're developing a good, strong group individual identity so that when the time comes and adulthood comes in at age 13, you have a good, strong, well-working individual identity with which to join into a group and become part of a group identity without having your individual identity disappear on you, but actually it'd be a very good positive contribution to the group identity. And a catastrophic failure to make that jump, when the time comes that you have to be a part of a group and a contributing member of a group with a well-working personality, if you show up with a personality that doesn't run right, it doesn't work. You're ashamed, embarrassed, afraid to jump into the group and fully participate because you know you haven't got the stuff. Something about you isn't ready to handle this challenge, and so you will try to find a group that you can hide in or participate in, and you'll end up joining the wrong group, and they will be doing little funny things, you know, and smoking funny things and swallowing funny things and acting funny ways, and none of them will actually putting demand to have a fully functioning personality. In fact, they will compete to see who can shut off the most of their personality most effectively, most of the time, and in the most outrageous ways, you see, and that will work very well. We call that addictions. Or, in fact, instead of participating in a healthy way, you'll begin to see how you can get your jollies off of everybody around you, as it's sometimes called, and we call that a sex addiction because you're no longer using your identity yourself to contribute positively to everybody. So now you see the very crucial task of developing an individual identity so you can have a group identity. Both of those tasks focus on the right orbital prefrontal cortex, which is nothing other than a street address for a spot in your brain. Right means it's on the right side. Orbital means it's behind the orbit or socket of your eye. Prefrontal means it's not all the way to the front. And cortex means it's on the outside of the brain. So we've got a little, map to where it is, and that tells us nothing other than that's where it is. Little spot of your brain, not quite all the way to the front, right behind your eye, that's kind of on the outside. But it sounds so impressive when you talk about it, right? There it is in the blue, right up there, you know, the right orbital prefrontal cortex. Just let that roll off your lips as you leave the conference. It is level 4 of the synchronization part of the brain we call the control center. And it's the top level of the control center. And so when properly trained and established, it is the one that has executive control. And in fact, it will retain executive control of your brain unless your own control center happens to fall apart. So we'll look now a little bit at this level 4 brain synchronization. The principles involved is, for the life model, it's the principle of maturing. And because it's the part of your brain that changes as you're mature. And so the first thing that would suggest to you is here's a part of the brain that's capable of changing throughout your entire lifespan, which in fact it is. And the spiritual dimension to this kind of change is that we are interested in not changing to become just anybody, but we're interested in becoming our true selves, the one that God had in mind when creating us. And so we're not just interested in any kind of growth or change, but the ones that lead us to Christ-likeness. And the part of the brain is the right prefrontal cortex, and what it does is direct your attention over time. If you delete this part of your brain, time becomes meaningless to you. You're always in the moment. You have no sense of before and now and future and stuff like that. Those are all parts of this part of the brain, your attention over time. So that's the capacity that it lets you acquire. So if you were to say, what part of the brain thinks of itself as you? This is the part that thinks of itself as you. It remembers that you were the one that was here yesterday, and it anticipates that you're the one that's going to be here tomorrow when we ask for you. If it's not running right, what we have is reactivity and drifting. Instead of acting like ourselves, we are reacting to whatever's going around us. We're drifting through life, responding to whatever's happening in our environment, but not taking the lead. We are not there representing ourselves. We're just trying to cope with whatever's coming our way. Again, you talk about an attention deficit disorder. People are responding and reacting to everything that's around them instead of their directing their lives and focusing on the things that you want to focus on. Now, that's the malfunction of this part of the brain produces a lack of complexity. Now, you've encountered this all along the way. You've encountered people that stopped growing, stopped learning, stopped developing. They stayed in some particular thought or another, and they never grew beyond that. They can't accommodate new ideas or new ways of doing things. They are just no longer becoming more complex. You give them a new idea, they go back to telling you what they always did and always said and always wanted and all the rest of that. They are no longer adding any complexity to themselves. The more this part of the brain grows, the more complex your view of yourself and the world becomes. You see, you've got more details, more things added to it, more history, more capacities, more understanding. In order to recover, this requires a community around you. You cannot by yourself upgrade your prefrontal cortex. Someone has to help you with it. And the people that have to help you with it are people who are significant to you individually. That's a community. And we've talked already, as you remember yesterday, on how you require a community around you to help you mature. Now, you know, also is very important for downloading or upgrading your banana, whichever way you want to look at it. You need a community around you, people that know how to act like themselves under distress in order to teach you and this part of your brain how to act like distress by sharing your distress with you. This part of the brain grows across your lifespan, but it takes vacations from time to time. And so what happens in your brain is at first the right side of your brain grows, and then the left side, and then the right side, and then the left side alternates back and forth. And so this prefrontal cortex is particularly trainable at certain times in life. And the main growth is from 0 to 18 months. Then it pretty much quits growing. Starts growing again about 3 years of age till 5 years of age. Then it pretty much quits growing, and it grows again from 7 to 10. And then pretty much quits growing, and it goes again to another growth spurt between 13 and 17 years of age. Each of these has a high point. So at 9 months of age, you are building the strongest possible bond you can with your mother. About 4 years of age, you're building the strongest possible bond you can with your father. At about 8.5 years of age, you're building the strongest possible bond you can with your buddies, your friends, your pals, your chums, your gang. At age 15, you're trying to form that bond with your life partner. We call it falling in love, puppy love. It's that euphoric feeling when you just, you know, some of you will remember that. It's the first of these growth spurts that we're consciously aware of, but that euphoric feeling like you're almost silly by, you know, even thinking about somebody, and you just kind of like, you know, feel like maybe your feet aren't on the ground anymore and it makes it hard to concentrate and all those kinds of things. That's what it feels like when your prefrontal cortex has been growing. Some of you will remember that because it happened when your first child was born, another time that this is revived. And a few of us had forgotten all about it until we had our grandbabies. And then all of a sudden there was something about the grandbabies and seeing them that revived this, and you thought that part of the brain had been long dead and so. And all of a sudden there it was in the grandbabies. So particularly for the first child, and especially for the mother, her biology is set to really grow then. But it must be said that the same thing happens to fathers as well, to such a degree that we can scan a guy's brain and tell whether he's been a father. Not in terms of genetic, has he produced an offspring, but has he actually engaged with a child in a fathering kind of a way? It'll alter your brain profoundly to such a degree the brain scan will reveal it. These are times of growth. So if we look at the growth, it alternates between the left and right hemisphere, and first the right hemisphere grows, then we have a left hemisphere growth. What happens during those times that the first growth of the left hemisphere? You know what happens then? They learn to talk. That's the biggest change. They go from about 15 months of age, they can say just a very few words. By the time that they're three, boy, can they talk. And during that time, all those language skills are acquired. So if you want to remediate joy bonding during that time, you're kind of out of luck. This is when the child wants to learn to talk and stuff like that. So then around the four-year age peak, you can remediate a lot of joy. You can rebuild joy again. But if you're trying to now teach them language skills, they're not all that interested. But around age 6 years of age is a great time to build language skills. Now there's a thought, maybe we should start kids in school, start teaching language skills about that time. Start at 4 years of age, that isn't what they want to do. And then around 9 years of age, again, 8 and a half, they're interested in relationships and language skills aren't big on the list anymore. And then you go into the next stage back and forth. So you see how these, 8 and a half, they're, yes, that's when they're in relationship, not language skills. And then about 11, they're back and wanting to learn those kinds of things. If you understand what's growing, you understand what's a good time to remediate things that you missed before. But you can get all of this out of affect regulation and the repair of the self by our extremely brilliant friend, Dr. Alan Shore. He also has this book, Affect Dysregulation and the Disorders of the Self, in which he points out that most of the things that we look at as a self that isn't running right comes basically because they haven't been able to regulate joy and the other feelings that we've been talking about, the big six. And again, these are the things that are contributors, serious contributors, not only to all the kinds of mental illnesses, but to bad parenting, to not being ready to be part of a group, which is what contributes to the disastrous start of most addictions. Now let's look in detail about this prefrontal cortex. There's the prefrontal areas looking from underneath on a brain scan that Dr. Eman provided. That's what they look like in a healthy brain. And that area right there actually develops into 35% of the adult brain if it's properly stimulated, but it wasn't present at birth. So you're born without it. You develop it, and the more that you stimulate it, the more it grows and the more that develops. So ultimately, it'll be about a third of your brain. And that's the part of you that learns to be like other people. That's your be-like stuff. And it's in there for the purpose of modeling yourself after other folks. And that's what it does during those times. It thinks in images and pictures and feelings rather than words on the right prefrontal cortex. It's the center for personal identity, so it's the part that thinks of itself as you. It's also the center for emotional regulation, whether we're talking about regulating our feelings or somebody else's in mutual regulation. It does joint-focused attention. Now, joint-focused attention is what allows me to direct your attention to what's on the screen. In order to do that, your brain has to do three points of view. It has to think of what you're doing. It has to be thinking about what I'm pointing out to you. And it has to be paying attention to the third thing out there that I'm indicating to you. So if you take a child before the prefrontal cortex starts developing at 9 months of age, and you're looking at the baby and you hold a toy over here, a doll, let's say, and look at the doll, the baby will not look at the doll. It'll keep looking at you. Can't do joint focused attention. After 9 months of age, when the prefrontal cortex comes on, you look at the doll, the baby looks over at the doll to see what you're doing. Now your dog, if you've got one, who hasn't got a prefrontal cortex, let's say, to write home to mother about, if you point at something at your dog will keep looking at you. Won't look over there to see what you're pointing at. It's pretty useless to point to the dog unless the dog has been trained that that's a signal to do something. But if you're just saying, hey, doggy, pay attention to that over there, the dog is just going, which is, in fact, what you do without a prefrontal cortex. This is what we call attention deficit. The prefrontal cortex is not on and running, and so you're not able to direct anyone's attention. When you can't direct it, you've got a deficit in directing attention, right? So joint-focused attention is the part that does that. It's also the part that lets you switch the focus of attention so that without this running, if you do pay attention to something, whatever you're paying attention to, you lock into and you don't change your attention off of that until you get your prefrontal cortex back on again. And it does three-way bonds, which means it not only lets you relate to one person, but it lets you relate to two people at the same time. Remember the cingulate cortex, the banana, can only do one other person at a time. This part of the brain can do two people at a time. Now, it can't share energy states with two people at a time, because you can only have one energy state inside your body. But it can do three points of view. So the part of your brain that thinks of yourself as you is actually configured in your brain in sort of the neurological equivalent of three faces looking at each other. So we could say that your identity center is really three of you that act like one of you. So you could say you're three or one, depending on which way you want to look at it. The three of us are me, or I am me. And so we have the idea that perhaps whoever designed this had an understanding of an identity that could be looked at as sort of three points of view, but would be one identity. And if you do that, this prefrontal cortex would be the perfect design if you wanted somebody to be able to sort of be in your image, shall we say. It also does personal preferences. Without this part of the brain, you can't choose what you like. You can solve problems in terms of what's the right or wrong thing to do, but they will be without your personal preference. So let's say you were going to Iowa in the middle of the winter. First of all, you could say, would that be a personal preference or not? But if you did, you could say to people, what is the right clothes to wear in Iowa in the middle of the winter? And people would probably appropriately answer warm clothes, you know, wool clothes, that sort of stuff. You don't need a prefrontal cortex to answer that. That's a right or wrong question. But if we say, out of all the warm clothes that you might have, which one would you prefer? Now you have to have your prefrontal cortex on to answer that. Because I've got a lot of warm clothes, but which one do I want to wear? Well, I don't know unless I know what I prefer. This is the question of personal style. And as you remember, developing your personal style and your personal sense of who you are very important child tasks, and they're also very important group tasks as a young adult. You have to develop this sense of style. If you have a deficit here, your prefrontal cortex isn't up and running with a good sense of your personal style, then you're going to do things that lack all kinds of style. And you notice that using drugs has never developed anybody's sense of personal style particularly well. It's an alternative, an escape from that. It's also the place where creativity happens. So you shut this part of the brain off, you no longer can be creative about solving problems. If it's on, you're creative. It also judges satisfaction. Now, the simple fact of the matter is, you can't be addicted if you understand satisfaction. There's nothing satisfying about addictions. You repeat them over and over and over and over again, you never say you're satiated. That was such a good high, I don't think I'll never need another high again for just, you know, I can't ever tell you till when. No, what you get with people who are pursuing a high is that you can't wait to get to the next high, and most of them aren't as good as the last one. And in spite of the fact that they continue to get worse and worse, and the results are worse and worse, and it's starting to kill you after a while, and it's ruining all your relationships, you never ask the question, is this really satisfying? Is this a way to live? Because if you did, you'd go, makes no sense. So you can't have satisfaction running and still practice an addiction. Also, goal-directed behaviors up here. Knock this part of the brain out, you can no longer do goal behavior, or more importantly, moral or social behavior. The capacity to make moral and social choices disappears with the damage of this part of the brain. And it is just not a good thing to lose. It also is the part that lets us correct our mindset, our interpretation of others. And so if our mindset is wrong, we're reading the cues wrong, we need to have our prefrontal cortex on in order to correct that. It also does time travel or age regression. Fancy words for, I can go back and remember what it was like for me to be younger. And so I'm the same person over time. If this part of the brain is off, you don't remember or know that you're the same person over time. Now, what happens, and I'll just stop and say a word about multiple personality. In multiple personality, which shuts off the brain at level 2, level 3 and level 4 are off. And so the part of your brain that knows that you're the same person over time is not actually on at the time that you're in the middle of the trauma. Consequently, you don't know that it was you that did or experienced or was present during all those things that your brain has a memory happened, but you just don't remember they happened to you if you should ever pull it back into your brain. And you would accurately remember it wasn't you because it wasn't you that was there at the time. That part of your brain was off, so you can say it never happened to me. Because the part of your brain that thinks it's you was off at the time, and it didn't happen to me. And all this begins to be just real clear. You know, all those mysterious things about how many people are there inside. It makes for wonderful movies, I tell you. But inside, you're just looking at what happens if different parts of the brain shut down. It's extremely predictable and understandable if you have this part of the brain on and not that part of the brain on. This is the effect it's going to have. Not particularly glorious, somewhat adaptable, but it is, you know, we can just drop all of that stuff about how many people are in there. That's how many parts of the brain don't know that the other parts of the brain are in there and that they're all part of one brain. Calming and controlling the amygdala is the other thing it can do. That's level two, but since we haven't talked about level two, that's a pointless point at this point. So, what does it mean to act like myself? Acting like myself means, above all else, that I stay relational. So, let's say that I'm angry, and I get angry at my wife. A nearly unthinkable thought, but should that happen, and I was to get angry at my wife. My wife is the person that I loved and romanced and decided to marry, right? If I stay relational, I'm still relating to her as the person I loved and romanced and wanted to marry, and you're your most special person in my life. So I should be able to say to her, you know, I'm mad at you, and you're the most special person in my life that I'm so glad I'm married to. That would mean to stay relational in the middle of it. You're the same person. All these things are still equally true as they were before you were angry. But if you lose the capacity to be relational, I stop relating to you as though you are my wife, the person I love, I cherish more than anyone else, and I want to be in relationship with. And I remember I would, you know, cross the ocean and climb the mountains and do all these things for you, and that's who I'm mad at right now. If that disappears, you're losing that relational capacity. It means I stay synchronized. Internally, my brain continues to work as though it were one brain. I stay synchronized with God because, after all, to be myself means that I still have the relationship with God. Now, this is a fun thing, you see. I never learned that early on. Remember what I told you my Norwegian ancestors did with me when I got angry? They would send me to my room and say, "You can, when you behave yourself, you can come back." Well, so I never learned how to be relational with other people. Well, after a while, I had someone come into my family who had a really good capacity to get angry. They were unusually good at this sort of thing. And it wasn't my wife. Don't worry about that. It was somebody else. And so they would yell at me. But, you know, they as they were angry with me, they were a new Christian. And they said to me one time, "Well," in fact, yelled at me rather angrily, "Why don't you pray? You're a Christian. Don't you pray when we're in trouble? We're in trouble right now. Aren't we in trouble?" Now, this is the first time my brain had ever had such a thought. That someone was really mad that this was a pretty good time to pray. I was like, that's news. But if I was relational to God, had my brain known that at the moment, and I was told it by a very angry person in an angry moment that said, "You know, one of the things really making me mad at you about right now is you seem to have forgotten all about your relationship with me and with God, and I really hate it when people forget about the relationship with me and with God. Isn't it about time we brought that into this?" Like, that's unheard of. But I can't argue with that. What would I pray about? What would I say? How would I talk to God? That sounds right. I think I had a relationship with God. Can you imagine the mystery that happened in my mind at that moment, that I was reminded I had a relationship with God in a state where I'd never had a relationship before? A mystery opened up. You know, actually, after a while, I found that talking to God in the middle of having people angry at you is a really good part of being me. I feel so much better about it. Once that became a practical reality to me, and I learned it in that moment, my brain learned how to stay in relationship with God and naturally with others. As a result, acting like myself means I do good works. And I act like my people when I'm in distress or pain. That's what this part of the brain does, right? It repeats what your people do. So the question is, who are your people? We'll review that Jesus acted like himself. Now, if Jesus is my people, one of the things that I'm going to do, since he's one of my people, is I will imitate him to the degree that I've experienced his presence and his style when he was mad and I was mad. But again, if no one ever reminded me to talk to him under those conditions and it remained a mystery to my mind doesn't automatically fill in that blank. So again, we're talking about directing the focus of our awareness. During the anger, to act like ourselves, somebody has to say to you, you think what it would be like you to do right now? As a Christian, perhaps it would be like you to do what Christians do. We would talk with God and with each other and, you know, you'd be helpful to me. News to me, you see. But if you do that, you learn to remain a relational person under distress. Which means you're acting like yourself and staying yourself in different emotions. If you were able to experience that in all the different emotions, then you would be able to answer what it's like you to do. You'd be the same person over time, no matter which emotions you landed in. So that means that if we're acting like ourselves, we're regulating our own feelings. We're helping others with their feelings, too, so that they can calm down. We act like ourselves by staying in desire and not fear. What does that mean? It means that we keep our prefrontal cortexes on and begin to think of what's my style, what's my desire, what's my preference, what would be the most satisfying thing for me to do right now? What would be the most creative thing I might do in the middle of this moment? What would it be like me to do in relationship to God and others? Who have I seen before? What new options are available? Which means that we show others what Jesus sees right then, because what's important at those moments of distress is whatever Jesus is pointing at and paying attention to right then, isn't it? Have any of you ever done any kind of inner healing experience when you invited Jesus into a distressing event? Has that ever happened to you? You ever seen anyone else go through it? We've got a little bit of experience that way. When Jesus enters a distressing event and you watch what he does, you pay attention to what's important to him and how he responds to the whole thing. By the time it's done, the whole thing means something different than it did before, right? It still happened. You don't deny anything about it. But Jesus showed you what was really important and what it was like us and our people to do an event as bad as that. That's what resolves the trauma for us. Now we know what it's like us and our people to do when something as bad as that happened. No one ever showed me that before. By watching him in that event, that's exactly what we learned. We learned to see what he sees and what he would do. That means that sin, which is what keeps getting in the trouble of this, sin is very much a kind of desynchronization. Christians have a terribly confused sense of self due to mistaken ideas about original sin, pride, and humility. The first question I have is, are you a Christian? General consensus here, not a lot of people are. Then shouldn't acting like a Christian and acting like yourself be the same thing? But in almost everyone's experience, it isn't. I teach a class of senior adults. They're mostly 70 to 90. They've all grown up in the church. They've been church leaders, many of them pastors, taught in seminaries and Bible schools and all the rest of that sort of stuff. But every time I ask them, even at this age, you know, what is it like you to do? They'll say, oh, that's terrible. So, well, aren't you a Christian? Oh, yes, 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 absolutely. Well, what would it be like to act like yourself? Oh, that's terrible. Their self is still not a Christian. At 70 to 90 years of age, it's really amazing. So we have this salvation without transformation, which is going on all around us. You see, we have people who are still... They've gotten the ticket to ride, you know. They'll make it through the pearly gates, but it hasn't changed anything about who they are. Their self is just the same self it was before they got the ticket to ride as afterwards. What we're talking about is how do you change the identity center so that who I am is actually becoming a Christian, not just what I think becoming a Christian. Now, original sin does not mean that we are sin. Our self is not sin. Let's have a careful look at a few verses. Romans 7:17, one of the big discussions on the subject in that chapter. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. Is Paul saying that sin and I are the same thing? No, there's a clear distinction in his mind. It isn't I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. Does sin dwell in us someplace? All right. Is it us? No. This is where we have to start real clearly. Can you read anything else in that passage? Maybe it's the only one that says so. I don't think so. Look at this. For I know that in me, sounds like he's talking about himself, but then he clarifies. He says, in my flesh dwelleth no good thing. So there's a particular part of what goes with Paul all the time called his flesh that doesn't have good stuff in it. All right? But he said above him here that that isn't him. But in case you still have some doubts, he goes on to say in verse 20, now if I do that I would not, it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. In other words, we've got a virus on board. Okay? If my computer got a virus in it, would it continue to act like itself? No, it'd be a mess, wouldn't it? It would be all kinds of stuff that isn't what I want this computer to do. And it would say, well, it isn't me that's doing that, it's the virus that's in me. And I would want to take the virus out if I could, or at least isolate it if I couldn't, and not let the computer be under the control of that virus so that the true computer could run things, the real self, the who I really am. Paul keeps saying, the real me is not sin. Sin is in me, it's always one influence, it's one effect on me, but he distinguishes consistently between his self and sin. His self, he says, is not sin. It dwells in me, it's got its influence on me, it affects me, it's a pain, but it isn't the true me. So what is it like me to do? If I act like my true self, will I sin? We have, however, a false self, a hallucinated sense of self, laid down in neurological circuits, literally in flesh, that's based on faulty explanations of our old experiences. All your brain can tell you about who you are is based on what you've done before and experienced before. And if those experiences were malfunctions, you and your people, as were recorded in there, were recorded with wrong messages, all it can say that who you are, based on what your brain knows, is going to give you wrong answers. It'll say, that's myself, but the answers will be wrong. That is flesh. It's actually literal flesh laid down in your brain. Paul couldn't have been more accurate physically if he said, you know, you have laid down in your physical being an entirely wrong sense of yourself that will give you the wrong answers about who you are and what it's like you to do. Don't go by that one. The real you, if you knew who you really are, wouldn't do that. What is sin? Sin is not acting like yourself. Ephesians 2:10 again. For we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works. What were you created to do? Good works. If you act like yourself as you're created to do, what would you do? Good works. And do we have a road back to doing good works? Hello, if you are in Christ Jesus, right? Are you a Christian? Then what is your real self about? If you act like your real self, what will you do? You'll do the good works that were already in mind for you to do. So sin then means you're being out of synchronization. What you're doing and planning to do is no longer acting like the person you really are, or what God is up to in the world, or what he had in mind for you, or you, or the people around you to be doing. It means that your timing is off. You're trying to be in joy when God's in sadness. You're trying to work while he's saying rest. You're trying to rest when he's saying work. Any of those being unsynchronized with what God has in mind, you're saying everything is fine when it isn't. Or everything is wrong when it's actually fine. Those are sin. Those are being out of tune. That's what it would mean to say we're malfunctioning. We're no longer acting like the person we were created to be. So there's deceptive synchronization. You can be synchronized with a group mind. Remember, you're part of a group. Suppose the group mind that we select is the world around us, our culture. Will we be told the truth about who we are by our culture, by the world? If we act like the way they tell us is our real self, will we get the answer right? Scripture calls that the world. Does that actually impact on our biological being? Absolutely, totally so. It's there. We have a group mind called the world that influences us and defines ourselves as far as our biological circuits are called. We can also be influenced by other spirits called evil supernaturalism by Ed Murphy. Some of you know him. Is that a good group to synchronize with? Or we can give up synchronization entirely and do what is right in our own mind and act according to our own flesh. Will we get it right then? Will we be acting like ourselves? Now, those are good places to not synchronize. So what is the relationship then between wholeness and holiness? Well, if we are creatures of synchronization and sin is not acting like ourselves and our brain only allows us to synchronize with one other mind, and if we were meant to synchronize with God, there's a thought, then we are both whole and holy when we stay synchronized with God through Jesus, who only did what he saw his Father doing, and we sin when we're out of synchronization, or if we synchronize with anything that is not God. We stop acting like ourselves, the people we were meant to be. So I would say that central to our well-being, as well as to our sanctification, is this idea of living a well-synchronized life, that who we are is synchronized with God and his view and his activity in the world at all times. So what happens to the brain during trauma? Well, what happens during trauma is that the left part of your brain gets shut off and the right hemisphere takes over. The first indication of being overwhelmed, as well as the persistent evidence of trauma, is a desynchronization or disconnection between the left and right hemispheres of the brain, when what we're experiencing doesn't match our explanation. The left hemisphere is involved in naming. It's a place of words, stories, language, descriptions. It's more interested in approaching things than avoiding things. It's the center for anxiety and guilt, which are parts of our explanations. It's very resistant to change. It persists in the face of contrary evidence and believing the same things. And it can only change its opinion when the right hemisphere is upset. So in order to upgrade any of our thoughts, we have to be upset in order to change our opinions. And it's the right hemisphere that decides when that happens and when we're allowed to change our opinions. Is this going a little too fast for all of you? I believe it is. I'd like to tell you all of this stuff is very nicely on the tape back there. The videotape has all of this material for your review. And so I want to suggest that you consider adding that to your arsenal if you get a little. The left and right hemispheres of the brain from above, as we do in this thing by this diagram by Damasio, you'll look at a little part of the brain over there called the somatosensory area on the right hemisphere of the brain. You see that brain right, that section of the brain right there? If you remove that part of the brain will never again be able to change its opinion about anything. That part of the brain will govern your capacity to change your thoughts and opinions. Now, the reason it's all the more remarkable is because somatosensory area, if you take that part of the brain out, the left side of your body becomes paralyzed. But a person who's had damage to that part of their brain will never change their opinion that part of their body is still okay. Even though the fact they cannot move their left side of their body, they will tell you they can. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not paralyzed. It's perfectly fine. You point out to them that you say, well, pick up that glass there. They try to, nothing happens. And you ask them about it. And they say, well, I picked it up. No, you said, it's still on the table. Well, I just don't want to. They will not change their opinion because prior to the damage to that part of the brain, they weren't paralyzed. That was the last information that was loaded in before that part of the brain was gone. They can't change it. They can't change their opinions about anything from that point on. The right side of the brain determines whether or not you can change your belief. And it changes your belief when you're upset. So, let's say you go back and you say, well, I went to this wonderful conference and I learned all about joy and how it applies to our church. And the person you're talking to is not upset about the lack of joy in your church. And they go, okay, well, it's okay. But I don't go with that. Or you said, I learned all these wonderful things about demons and what to do about them. It doesn't matter if you give them evidence to the contrary of everything they believe, they don't change their opinion because they aren't upset about it. But now let's say, for instance, the same pastor who wouldn't change his opinion, suddenly his daughter begins manifesting some kind of a demon and it upsets him. At that point, that brain is open to new information and might change. The information it put in might be better or worse, but change is available. See, now the wonderful thing about the genius of this plan is that God has built a brain. You might notice that I think God built a brain. But he built a brain that will remain chronically unstable as long as what it believes is false. But once you have true information in the brain, you cannot change its opinion. So it's a brain that was designed around someone who highly valued truth to such a degree that it is unstable for the rest of your life every time you enter that area of your life, and will become upset if what you're believing isn't completely true and match your experience. But once you have some explanation that's fully true, that matches your experience in the right hemisphere, your brain becomes stable from that point on. You can't be traumatized or stop acting like yourself. Now that strikes me as a great plan. Because the right hemisphere does your knowing, but it's nonverbal. It thinks in images, and it's prosodic, which means it pays attention to voice tone. You ever hear somebody say to you, well, it wasn't what you said, it's the way you said it? That's your right hemisphere is going, I don't care what the words were, the tune was off. It's the executive control system of your brain with the four levels control structure we've talked about, dominant for emotions in the body, synchronizes and notices everything, and because it's paying attention to everything, it doesn't have its attention focused on details. Unless the whole picture adds up, it doesn't believe it, doesn't take it. And so you have to give it an explanation that takes care, accounts for everything. And if it doesn't, it gets upset. And when it's upset, then your left hemisphere can change its beliefs. Now, the left hemisphere is where we store all of those beliefs that we've had along the way. All the unresolved traumas contain old but still active Sark tales or flesh tales or some tales that's come from our own understanding rather than God's view of things. And these explanations of what's good and bad govern our lives, and we have pain and fear unless they're removed. The Sark explanations always cause damage and leave the two hemispheres unsynchronized. So let me rejoin my story that I was telling you before. The pastor was pointing down, or all seven pastors, and said, you know, you killed him. Now that went into there, and my explanation of that was that I was a very bad boy. I was a killer and a very bad boy by nature. And so my basic nature, my true self, was a killer. Okay, and does that, then if I'm going to act like myself, what am I going to do? Kill. Now that always upset me. That's a sign that doesn't make my brain run in a stable way. And anybody with wisdom would have said, well, there's got to be something about that isn't true, or your brain would be stable and peaceful. But you've got instability. So something about you being a bad boy and a killer is off. It's wrong. There's something not quite right about that. However, in another way, we could look at it and say, well, what the preacher is saying is absolutely true in another way, isn't it? So, but even though you tend to, was I bad? Was I capable of sinning? Am I capable of killing? Yes, but when I'm doing those things, I'm not acting like my true self. I am sinning now. I'm malfunctioning in a big way. I'm not doing the good works that God ordained ahead of time that I should walk in them, right? But my brain now believes that that would be what I'm designed to do. There is part of the error, you see. It's not that I wouldn't be able to do such things, that I couldn't malfunction, but that's who I would really do if I was being myself. That's wrong, but how do you sort that out at 4 years of age? Well, even at 24 years of age or whatever else. But these explanations weren't there. In fact, I didn't notice them until people were inviting me to Good Friday services. And I go, I hate Good Friday. I don't know why I can't go to church on Good Friday. And just like that is such a depressing. I just feel go away rotten. I love Easter. I love Easter. Easter is great, but I won't go to church on Good Friday. By this time, I'd graduated from seminary and all the rest of that, had all my theology right, but there was something not quite right. So I began this 8-step process for resolving traumas. First, I find the upset. That's what the right hemisphere knows. The upset in this case is I felt really bad and sad, okay, and terrible about myself. And the belief that goes with it, which is what your left hemisphere knows. How it explains it. How does it explain my feeling upset? Well, it feels upset because, you know, I'm a killer and I killed Jesus. And even though I know that I didn't literally do that, I would have if I could have. I mean, this is where I'm stuck with the whole thing. So I'm saying this is who I really am, and I'm feeling upset about it. And so I bring those two things into my consciousness and I hold the two of them there at the same time. Then I ask the Holy Spirit to find the best evidence of that. Why am I so upset about this whole thing? And it was at the point that I asked that this picture of sitting on a bench as a little boy on a Friday afternoon in the hot tropical climate with these preachers pointing one after another first popped into my mind. That's what convinces me that I'm such a bad boy and why I hate Good Friday and why this whole, yeah, That's, you know, I hadn't thought about that in years, decades. I invite Jesus into that event or evidence. I said, okay, Jesus, would you come back to be with that little four-year-old boy sitting on the bench listening to these sermons? What is Jesus going to do? What is he going to answer? What is he going to say, you know? And test the evidence of my conclusion by asking God to reveal the truth to me. Is it true that I killed you, that I killed Jesus, that I'm a bad... Is that the truth? Now, I don't try to tell myself that, but if the truth is revealed to me, what will happen is my hemispheres will synchronize for the first time. What I experienced and what happened will all make sense to me. And then you check for peace and rest internally. Synchronized operation of the whole brain. Now we've arrived at the point where I think about all of you would like to know, and what did Jesus do there? Right? Because we all know this is what it hinges on. What did Jesus do there? Well, a thought passed through my mind, after which an enormous peace came upon me and I started to cry. And the thought was, you were just a little boy. Now that thought might not mean much to you, but it just about chokes me up to think about it. Because I realized sometime after that what really bothered me about the whole event, more than anything else, was that if I was a little boy and I had more power than the one I depended on to do everything, take care of everything, to make the universe right for me. You see, I could kill the one that I depended on. I was the scariest being in my own known universe. And he said to me, you aren't this big creature that killed me. You're little compared to me. And when I understood that, then I could be as bad as I ever needed to be, because the one who is much bigger than me could take care of all of that. And I cried because it was very sad what happened to him. And that's what a little boy would do. Maybe even a big boy, I don't know. But I've always been little in comparison to him ever since, you see. And then that lets me ride through the universe in a much safer place than when I'm a danger to God. See? Something inside me resolved. That's true. Now I can be myself. I can let him be his self. And that's what I needed to know. It might not have been what anyone else needed to know. That's what I needed to know. Jesus really still was a whole lot bigger than me, even when he was dying. That's why I still, you know, most of the teachings that I teach about is about how Jesus is still so much bigger than us, and he can handle trauma that would be trauma for us by just suffering and being there with us, you see? And when that happened, I had peace inside. I was sad, but I had peace, and I was back to joy because I could put my head on Jesus' shoulder in his lap and his bosom and say, I'm glad to be with you. You understand my being sad. And if there's still a few details in there that still bother you about the story, repeat it. You know, go through it again, because sometimes there's more than one, shall we say, lie in the whole event. Does that make sense to you? This is the process for balancing the two hemispheres. And then when you're done, the difference between the pagans and the Christians is that we give thanks. And so we thank God for what he has done for us and how he's helped us balance our brains. And we will be able to do this for any traumatic event that we can keep in our awareness. What that means is, if you haven't got enough joy strength to keep something in awareness, you won't go through this process of healing with it. And Jesus will wait to deal with that until you've developed enough joy strength for you to be able to bring it into your awareness, which might be later on. And you develop most of your joy strength by virtue of good, old-fashioned fellowship with people who are joyful to be with you. So trauma is resolved when your control center can answer the question, what is it like me and my people to do when we are this upset? At that point, you know how to act like yourself and your people. You're no longer traumatized. You know exactly what you would do. In my case, I learned that I was too little to handle all of that, to do all of that. And so what it was like me to do was to be little and let God be big, and that was very reassuring, because that in fact fit my reality incredibly well. The answer has to be a true explanation that matches the story in the left hemisphere. In other words, if the truth, it isn't true, it just won't settle the brain. So again, the difference between trauma and suffering: trauma reduces who we are, and who we understand ourselves to be. I went from being a person that God could use to a really bad little boy who never really wanted to get too close to people for fear that they would discover how mean, bad, and wicked I really was inside. Suffering, on the other hand, we're at peace with ourselves in the world. And though I was still little, I still thought Jesus could be with me and he could use me in the middle of suffering. And this is a different change, quite a change in who I was. And sufferers find their capacities reduced. Sometimes you just can't do very much. But with whatever you have, you continue to be the person God created you to be. That's what it means to be traumatized. So our identity in Christ is both individual and corporate. As children and infants, we have an individual identity in self, and we also have a group identity. We're part of a people. Who are our people? The proper brain function requires a working group identity. And so we not only are part of restoring our own individual identity, but we have to be actively involved in restoring our group identity to where it functions correctly as well, because it's malfunctioning around us just as much as our individual identities are. Not only do our individual brains desynchronize, our corporate brains, our corporate minds, this mind that should be in us, plural, that was also in Christ Jesus, tends to desynchronize at us at times, and we lose joy, and we get out of joy, and we forget who we are and what it's like us to do. So proper brain functioning for every individual means that the group identity around them also has to be running right. Earning adult maturity means forming a group identity, and addicts fail to complete the group identity correctly. That's where it all falls apart for them. So as we're looking for how we restore them, we're headed for the point where they can be part of a working group identity. Then you know your job with dealing with addiction is finished. Until they've joined a working group identity, their recovery isn't over. So who are my people? Well, a child has an idea of a group mind that involves the people that share consciousness with him or her, that do mutual emotional regulation, and share a sense of reality with you. For a child, that's who forms their group identity. Now, an adult, they also have a group mind with their people, and the people who are form the group identity for adults are those who share states of consciousness, do mutual emotional regulation, and have shared reality with them. You notice the difference between that and what children do? Let's go back. Children, shared states of consciousness, mutual emotional regulation, and shared identity. But for adults, it is shared states of consciousness, mutual emotional regulation, and shared identity. All right. Exactly. These are the same processes that are involved for both. The degree to which they affect our sphere of influence is greater, and we're much more active in a two-way process as an adult, but we're still involved in shared states of consciousness, mutual emotional regulation, and shared identity. Let me ask you the question. Is that the characteristic of your family? Is that the characteristic of your church? Is that how you would describe the process of discipleship in your church? Is that how you would describe the process of small group formation in the Christian body that you grew up with or that you're in now? Is this what happens when people get upset in the church that you are most familiar with and emotionally connected with? If this isn't what's happening, then we are not forming a group identity. It also means that we're a terrible answer for any addict who needs to form a group identity. As a matter of fact, when we talk about recovery, no place does desperation start to set in the people I'm talking to more deeply than when we talk about where do I go to find a group identity that will share any of these things with me. And although people might have hope that someplace someone might individually care about me, the chances of finding a group, let alone a church group, that would do any of these things with them, run them into a despair that's beyond words. It's like this has never been seen or heard of, and in fact none of the churches that I know of are even anticipating or desiring to do these things. As a result, we have a group of Christians that have no change whatsoever in their identity since they've become Christians that really helps them when they're under distress. We have no theology of suffering. We send missionaries out to areas of the world where there's all kinds of suffering going on with no form of Christianity that actually addresses how do we deal with that and develop the kind of Christian character that can handle the suffering. And so we blow missionaries up left and right as though they were Hummers over in Iraq, you know. They're just exploding left and right and being dragged back. The necessary skills to be part of a relationship are these. You have to have a secure attachment. Your sense of belonging has to be intact. You have to have the capacity for emotional regulation, both mutual and self. You have to have enough joy strength to resolve loss. You have to know how to return to joy from all emotional states. And you have to have a synchronization of all four levels of your control center, which means you are acting like yourself under distress. A working internal interpreter of others, which means you have a clear idea of what actually other people are thinking and experiencing. You ever encounter that in Christian leadership where you were talking to them and they had really no idea what you were actually thinking and feeling, and you felt like whatever's going on in their brain has nothing to do with what I'm trying to tell them? And the ability to repair ruptures in relationships. You see, most of the time in church, we are trying to build a church in which nothing will go wrong. This is an extremely fragile church. Unlike my uncle with the car that could get dirty and you could wash it again, nothing could go wrong, because if it ever goes wrong, we'll never know how to fix it. We need to build churches in which we are able to repair those things that go wrong. We know how to get back from all the things that go wrong. Without a theology and a church and a body that can get back from those things that go wrong, you're never going to be able to deal with addictions, let alone sex addictions, in which the things that go wrong are extremely horrific and upsetting to all of us because they touch our deepest chord. It is all about being able to repair those ruptures. So, if you were going to train someone for times of trouble, who would you train? Would you train the ones that would be in charge or those that leave and don't come back until it's over? Well, how about the Normandy Beach invasion? Any of you old enough to go back to World War II and remember the Normandy Beach and the terrible, on Omaha Beach, the terrible losses that we had? Well, it turns out that all the soldiers that first landed on Omaha Beach were raw recruits, had not been in combat before. None of them knew how to act like themselves when they were being shot at by a machine gun. Okay? So what do you do when you're being shot at by a machine gun? Well, what they did is what most people would think that you do. You hide behind something. And what happens if you hide behind something, you have simply set a time limit before you get killed. Because sooner or later it's going to get you. You just are going to extend that period of time. After a while, a group of soldiers that had seen combat in Italy landed on Omaha Beach, and they did what acting like themselves meant for seasoned troops. You know what that means? You run straight at the machine gun as fast as you can and as directly as you can. Now, most of us think that's the fastest way to get killed. But if you've actually been in combat, that's the best way to avoid being killed. You run straight at the machine gun as fast as you can, and it wasn't a matter of more than minutes, really, before that machine gun was silenced, and that was the end of the slaughter on Omaha Beach. No one knew how to act like themselves in combat. So who would you train? The ones that are going to be on the beach? Would that make sense to you? How about astronauts? You know, you can't call AAA up there. They won't come tow you back. So they teach astronauts how to fix everything, because if it's going to get fixed, you're going to have to do it, right? In our brain, it's the control center. In times of trouble, your control center is what takes over. So wouldn't it make sense to train that part of your brain to handle distress? If your training doesn't go to the control center and it goes to the left hemisphere, which disappears every time there's distress, you've just trained the part of your brain that's going to be switched off until it's all over. What chance does that have of actually handling the suffering when it comes along? It doesn't work with the hardware. So you want to train the part of your brain that does emotional regulation, this control center we've been talking about. Do you remember, it's always in charge of the brain. It's the top of the command hierarchy. It shuts down the rest of the brain until the trouble is over and is passed. It's located in the right hemisphere, developed during the first 24 months, as is four levels. That's who you want to be training, because if you build the joy and the return to joy circuits in the control center, it prepares that brain to suffer well, to recover from trauma, and to prevent future traumatization. You know, if you know how to act like yourself under trouble, the next time trouble comes along, you're not traumatized, you just act like yourself. You see, so future traumatization is avoided. The same thing can happen to you again, but it won't be trauma this time. Will it be suffering? Well, yes, of course. Have we been promised that we won't have any suffering? No. Well, we ought to prepare for it, you see? Then let's look at how the brain does that, you see. We suffer well when we stay synchronized. It's a case of intelligent design, I tell you. Jesus knew what he was doing when he made our brains. This is where my theology comes right out here. This is what I believe. This is why I think we ought to pay attention to the brain. Because I don't think it was designed by an idiot. If, in fact, Jesus knew what he was doing when he designed the brain, then what he teaches us ought to have an effect on the brain he designed, right? And so I think he knew what he was doing. He meant for us to live in bodies and to serve God. That was his design. And Jesus himself intended to inhabit one of these bodies and use one of those brains himself. Right? He knew from before the creation of the earth that he was going to be trying out one of those suits. Now, I'll just tell you for myself, if I knew I was going to be trying one of these things out, I'd be real fussy about how I made the thing, right? Yeah. I would especially be inclined if I, you know, to make it run the way it was supposed to. And he knew he was going to be inhabiting one that was already not really fully the way he first designed it to, but he must have put enough capacity into it so it could still do what it needed to be done if you lived a life that he planned to show us to live. You see? Because he made the human body and the brain run right. Proof that it can be done. And should be tried. With his help. That's what he's come about to do. He says in a human body you can actually serve and please God and do the things that were designed ahead of time that you should walk in them. That's my plan. See, that's what I've come to do. That happens to be the good news. Now, to do that, you're training the control center. The better trained and equipped the control center is to stay synchronized, the longer and the better it will be at handling distress. Rather than becoming desynchronized or traumatized, the person will suffer well and still remain him or herself. The emotional control center is trained to suffer well through relationship, visual example, emotional story and song, but not through propositional truth or didactic teaching. Now, is there any chance that the master was interested in relationship, visual example, emotional story, song, and that he practiced that as part of his training of others? Okay? With it, we got the didactic teaching and propositional truth as well, didn't we? But I don't think he ever intended that that would be the part that would run the show. We're training the control center. It learns in relationships, from examples and models, through emotional picture stories. Was Jesus good at telling those? I think so. He's onto something right there. All of this training is nonverbal except for music and poetry, and it can only be taught with rhythm and tone. These are all synchronization functions. So you learn this when someone synchronizes with you and you learn to synchronize with someone else in the middle of your distress. The right hemisphere's nature sees the whole picture at once, concerns itself with emotional reality and identity. It decides whether we can and can't change our point of view and beliefs. It's dominant for all identity issues and dominant during times of distress and trouble. This is who we want to train, isn't it? Right there. Right hemispheric truth is synchronized to shared states of consciousness and reality. In other words, if you will share my state of consciousness and reality, then you may change it. You may then be one of my people and show me what it's like us to do. It's entirely relational, nonverbal, can only synchronize with one other person at a time. It's concerned with identity, how do I act like myself and my people, and it's limited by our emotional regulation capacity. That is, as soon as the thing becomes too intense for our joy level, then we no longer can keep synchronized. So would you anticipate that somebody who wanted us to suffer well would say, I came teaching you this so that my joy might be in you and you might have a big, enormous amount of capacity for joy. Right? And he did that just the day before he told all of you are going to malfunction, right? You're all going to fall apart. But don't worry about it, because someone is coming who is going to lead you into all of truth. And every time you see the Holy Spirit show up, you find joy and peace in the same verse, practically without exception throughout the New Testament. And in fact, we are told to teach one another through songs. Speak to one another with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Sing and make music to your heart in the Lord. So we are supposed to teach each other through songs. I, in fact, have been in violation of Scripture throughout this entire 2 days. Because if I was going to train your control centers how to do this, I would be singing to you. But in fact, the examples I've had have been so pitiful that I continue to malfunction in your presence, and I now admit it to you. The only example I ever really had was my mother, who used to sing to my brother and I when we'd get into a fight or we'd get angry with you. She would begin to sing, "Be ye kind to one another, be ye kind to everyone." And it annoyed my brother and I something fierce. But, you know, we would sit in the middle of that going, okay, all right, what are we supposed to do? But the interesting thing to me is I got to be around my 40s, was that people would begin to remark to me about when I was in the middle of church conflicts or staff conflicts or other kinds of conflicts, and say, you know, the funny thing about you is that even though there's a big fight going on here, you always seem to be kind. And if I would look at people and they'd be in conflict with each other, I'd always think to myself, you know, there's a kinder way to do that. And I never really paid attention to where that might come out of until all of this came to my attention. I realized that I was trained that what it would be like me to do through that song, which was annoying at the time, was to think of being kind in the middle of my distress. And so it's come to be a natural part of my identity. I don't think about it at all. It's like, well, what else would you do? Wouldn't you feel terrible if you weren't being kind in the middle of all of that distress? Now, imagine if your average church board was in that mood. See? I mean, already we'd like church board meetings better than some. We're supposed to not only do that, but we're supposed to let the word of Christ dwell richly in you. Anybody opposed to that? Okay. With all wisdom, problems with that? Teaching and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns. So, last time the church corrected you, did they sing to you? Last time you were admonished and taught, were you sung to? See, that would get to your control center because it would listen to the song. It would change who you are. If you just quote them the verse, it doesn't. It doesn't go to the right part of the brain. Somebody who understood the brain was saying, this is the way you should correct and admonish people within this church if you want to change their identity. It isn't happening, so consequently it isn't working. And I have done a terrible job of showing you how to do all of this because I'm about as badly equipped as the rest of you. But now I'm going to tell you why it is that this entire bit of teaching isn't going to be the slightest bit of use to you when you go out and face suffering. You'll remember afterwards why you malfunctioned so badly, and you'll be able to explain all the theory, but you won't be one inch closer to doing this. That's why we are going to do some suffering together tomorrow, and why we have programs like Thrive, where we get people together, and we suffer and sing and do things like that together, music, for a week, to begin to, you know, share some of these states and be together long enough to do it. But it seems again to me that there's a case of intelligent design here. There is no propositional answer to suffering well. The brain is not configured in a way that makes obedience through logical, language-based propositions possible during suffering and distress. The only way we can avoid sin while using a human brain is to learn to synchronize with God while we are suffering. Joy makes this possible. I think it might be informative or interesting to us if we notice that two of the lines that Jesus spoke on the cross are direct quotes out of Psalms, in other words, songs. I think there's every reason to believe that Jesus maintained who he was on the cross by singing those songs. And if you realize that he and David wrote those songs about what it was going to be like on his crucifixion day centuries before, it's a very powerful song to have written to sing to yourself during those times. And those two songs, one started out saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? And another one was, into your hands I commend my spirit. Read those two songs and see what it is that Jesus very likely was singing to himself while he was up there to maintain his identity. If he was working with a human brain, I find this incredibly likely, especially when you look at the songs. Somebody really wrote the songs for those days. So go back and read your songs. Building our joyful identity strength and learning our ways back to joy develop the capacity to suffer well and act like ourselves. Let's see, do we have time for questions? No. In fact, I have overrun my grace period, and I need to